Good day and welcome to Letters in Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. When we think of the philosopher Socrates, we likely think of an older gentleman dressed in a toga wandering the streets of ancient Athens asking questions. Questions that would inevitably lead to his execution. Important to note, an execution that would come about through the democratic process. We know about Socrates through other ancient writers, as Socrates was not known to have written down anything himself. Instead, we get Socrates primarily through three ancient writers, that being Aristophanes, Xenophon, and of course, Plato. All three of them have portrayed Socrates as an older gentleman. The very earliest account you would get from him would be Socrates as a middle-aged man. So, what about Socrates' younger life, and how would Socrates become this philosopher that is commonly associated with the founding of the Western philosophical tradition? Well, that's what we are going to be in conversation about today, and joining me for that is Armand Dengor. Armand Dengor is Associate Professor of Classics at Oxford University, and he is the author of the book Socrates in Love, The Making of a Philosopher. He joins us via Skype. Armand Dengor, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to this radio program.
Thank you very much, Mitch. Nice to be here. Thank you very much, Mitch. Nice to be here.
It's good to have you. I always enjoy these kind of conversations. As I said, we don't have anything written from Socrates himself. In fact, if you'll correct me if I'm wrong on this, he may not have written anything down. He wasn't known for writing things down. What we know from Socrates is from people who are younger than he was, who were, I guess, tutored by Socrates, Aristophanes, Xenophon, and Plato. It almost reminds me of the story of Jesus Christ. Of course, Jesus Christ didn't write things down. We know of him because of the disciples. So let me begin with this question. Is there a debate in the classical world as to whether Socrates even ever actually existed?
No. We certainly know he existed. There is a lot of evidence for his life. Of course, it is literary evidence, written evidence, rather than documents or inscriptions or objects. So ancient history, on the whole, has to make do with the written evidence that creates a tradition, in the case of Socrates, a very substantial tradition of biographical writing, of which we have a vast amount from his main pupil, Plato. You mentioned a couple of other names. So one of them is the comic playwright Aristophanes, who wrote a play called The Clouds in 423 BC, when Socrates would have been around 47 years of age. And that play survives as a complete dramatic piece, and the central character in it is someone called Socrates, is a philosopher based on Socrates himself. So we can get some evidence for his earlier life in his 40s from that play. And, of course, it's a comic play, so it's going to be distorted evidence. And that will be the kind of evidence I would want to look for to think about his earlier life, because, as you said, Plato and Xenophon, who are the two major biographers of Socrates, were much younger than him. They were probably in their teens when he was already in his 60s. So they would only have known him as an older man.
Tell me more about Aristophanes and this play, The Clouds. It almost makes fun, I guess I would say, of a middle-aged Socrates.
It does indeed. So Aristophanes was the greatest playwright of his generation. That is the last quarter of the 5th century BC and the early part of the 4th century BC. And this play, as a lot of the other comic plays which survive from Aristophanes, we have 11 complete ones. This play takes a liberal aim at his target. I mean, he was a satirist. He parodied and satirized and burlesqued characters such as Socrates. So in this particular one, he takes the figure of a slightly older, very loquacious, very disputatious philosopher, and he calls it Socrates, and he has Socrates running a school for thinking, which is given a name in Greek, which could be translated as the thinking shop.
And don't you even call it the thinkery?
the thinkery, yes. I mean, that's one good translation, I think. It's a slightly quack way of, you know, talking about a school, a thinkery, a place where people are made to think about things, which those particular things in Aristophanes' play are things like, how does a mosquito create a buzz? How does thunder happen? Things like, of that kind, of which we have in the modern world physical explanations, but in the ancient world they didn't. So they speculated. And in this comic play, of course, the ideal speculation is that these things are all about farting. So when gods fart, you know, you get thunder. When a mosquito farts, it buzzes. So this is the kind of thing that Aristophanes is doing as a comic playwright. He's bringing down to a very low register the kind of things that he attributes to this thinking person, Socrates, running his thinkery.
And even the name of the play, The Clouds, is it suggesting that Socrates, he's in the clouds, his head is already always in the clouds? Yeah.
Yes, it's the idea that somehow, in fact, the clouds in the play are the chorus of the play. They're cloud goddesses. So ancient Greeks had gods and goddesses who were the phenomena of nature, sun, the moon, the winds, and so on. These were all divine, but they didn't have cloud gods or goddesses. So it's a brilliant invention of Aristophanes. Why not have clouds as goddesses? And if they're going to be goddesses, what would they be goddesses of? And he says, airy fairy conversation. So actually, the clouds, as the chorus of the clouds, are the representatives of the kind of airy fairy thinking and speaking that Aristophanes and no doubt other Greeks of his time attributed to Socrates and his school, or that's the way they thought of it. I mean, Socrates probably didn't have a school of any kind, but he was lumped together with a group of very bright speakers and thinkers of his time called the Sophists. And these Sophists were looked on with a dim view by a lot of contemporary Athenians as basically peddling words. Because as I said, they didn't have a lot of actual scientific knowledge. So when they came up with their ideas, people thought, oh, well, it's just words, isn't it? What do they actually know?
Also interesting to think about for a society that had a god for almost everything, did not have them for clouds. What if this is, and I don't know if satire is the correct word, but certainly a comedy about Socrates, what do you have faith in through this play that actually would tell you about his earlier biography?
Well, one of the things that I found very interesting is, if I were a comic poet like Aristophanes, I would make fun of someone's looks, and he does. He talks about people being bald or fat or ugly in all sorts of his other comedies. But he doesn't say that about Socrates. What he says is that Socrates and his disciples in the thinkery are emaciatedly thin, they have long hair, they wear ragged clothes. This is not the picture that we get from Plato and Xenophon of the older Socrates, where he is paunchy, he is ugly, he looks like a satyr, which is like this animal-like creature, and he's bald. You know, he's not like that in 423 BC. Otherwise, I'm sure Aristophanes would have said so. And so I think that's one indication we can get of a Socrates who in his 40s had no longer developed the paunch and had not yet developed the paunch, but was someone who could still have been a fighter, as we know he was. He was a soldier in Athenian armies until his late 40s. And he tells us, or his words are in one of the books written by Xenophon, that when he stopped fighting, he grew a paunch and he needed to get fit again. So maybe if he stopped fighting, we know he fought when he was 48. So let's say he stopped fighting at 50. After that, he became the paunchy older man that we know in the busts of Socrates from ancient times. Before that, well, if Aristophanes is telling us that he's thin and straggly haired, that's what he must have looked like.
This is important, especially the idea, and I didn't know this until I read your book. Socrates must have spent the first half of his adult life, at least, in the military as a soldier.
Absolutely right. We know of him fighting in about a dozen campaigns, three big ones with lots of battles going on in them, from 432 onwards. So in 432, he was 37. But you don't start fighting as a hoplite soldier, that means a heavy armed infantryman, in an Athenian battle phalanx. You don't start fighting at 37. Ancient Greek hoplites had to start fighting, well, they were training from the age of 18. They probably started fighting in active service at the age of 20. And so there's no reason to think that Socrates wasn't one of those. He'd fought all his life. And in fact, he's notably heroic. He's a great soldier by the age of 37 in Battle of Potidaea in 432 BC. He is shown as being an extremely brave and very strong soldier. So I reckon he had quite a career, and we should imagine that he was fighting from his 20s onwards, and as you say, half his life.
I think this is important to understand about ancient Greece, which is, in Athens in particular, Greece is a big word, actually. It means many different city-states. But the democracy in Athens, and we think of Athens as being a democracy, but it was also an empire, a military empire. Socrates would have been part of this.
That's right. So Athens was a democracy in its own city-state. So within its own confines, it was a democracy insofar as there was one man, one vote, and it was one man. So it wasn't a democracy in our sense. Women didn't vote, but then, of course, they didn't until the 20th century anyway. But there were also slaves. There were also young people who didn't have the vote and so on. But it was one man, one vote. And yet it was, as you say, the leader of hundreds of smaller states in Athens, in Greece in the 5th century. And in the end, what started off as an alliance with those islands and cities around the Aegean Sea became an empire. Athens actually imposed its military might on its so-called allies. And so it was called openly an empire run by a democratic constitution.
And this empire would go, and the league you're speaking about, I believe, is called the Delian League. Maybe in some ways, I tried to understand it. You can think of NATO today. But when a city-state would try to withdraw from a Delian League, Athens would militarily put it down. And Socrates was a part of that too, wasn't he?
Well, he must have been. I mean, we don't know about, as I say, the early campaigns in which he fought. Certainly in 432, when we know he did fight in Potidaea, that was a campaign to subdue one of the so-called allies of Athens who had decided they wanted to withdraw. So it's a bit like Britain today withdrawing from the European Union, as if the EU would suddenly decide they would take military vengeance. So that's what Athens was doing. It was taking vengeance on a city-state, Potidaea, that had decided to withdraw from the alliance. So they sent several thousand troops up to Potidaea in northern Greece in order to subdue it.
Where does the life of Socrates fit into the story of democracy in Greece, or in Athens in particular?
Well, Socrates himself may have been somewhat suspicious of the kind of radical democracy that was practiced in his time. So what happens, of course, when you give everyone the vote is you start pandering to them. You start saying, look, you know, vote for me, keep, you know, me as your leader, and then I will give you freebies of some kind. And so Pericles, who was the leading general and who was voted time and time again by the people to be the general, the leader of the armed forces, you might say, of Athens, was famously a populist who, for example, gave the common people opportunities to earn money as jurors in these large juries that they had of 500 or more, which would have to serve in cases brought from the so-called allies, the city-states. If they had some big legal case, they would have to bring it to Athens. And the jurymen were Athenians who would be paid. So that was a kind of inducement to vote for people like Pericles, who would give these incentives to the people. So that kind of democracy, radical democracy, which meant that you started to pander to popular taste, was something that we get hints of Socrates not really approving of. So that's one way in which he was involved. He was involved also by teaching some of the upper class young men who vocally disapproved of that kind of democracy. So in a radical democracy, you vote on everything. The whole people, that is the adult male citizens, join together and vote on peace and war and so on. And so let's say you have a popular leader saying, look, it would be a really good idea to make war on this or that city state. And the people clamor, yes, what a great idea. And the aristocrats and the landed people are tearing their hair out and saying, this is no good for us. You know, we want to sell our wine and our olives and so on. We have all these estates, and this is going to disrupt all our source of income. So they didn't really approve of democracy being the kind of thing which everyone could have a vote for. And they tended to form cliques, and these are known as oligarchic cliques. And at various stages, these oligarchic cliques decided, let's get rid of this democracy, let's overthrow it. And there are two particular occasions in the course of the late 5th century when the democracy is overthrown for a short period by oligarchic cliques. And Socrates taught these elite young men. He taught them because basically there was no further education in Athens until the so-called sophists, who I mentioned, these clever men, started to come and teach about all sorts of subjects ranging from astronomy to how to give a good speech. And Socrates was seen to be one of those, but actually he was trying to teach people how to be better. Nonetheless, of course, he was seen as a teacher, and the adult elite men flocked to him, so, you know, the 20-year-olds, and they were the people who then also formed the backbone of these oligarchic groups who wanted to overthrow democracy. So Socrates was inevitably associated with them, even though it seems unlikely that he was an agitator of any kind himself. So when the Athenians lost the Peloponnesian War, which they were fighting against Sparta and its allies, in 404 BC, they lost that war after over 20 years of fighting. The democracy for a short time had to give way to an oligarchy, which was imposed by the victors, the Spartans, who were not that keen on democracy. And that, in turn, was overthrown by the Democrats. The Democrats had managed to gather their forces outside of Athens, and they fought a battle with the oligarchs, and they won. And democracy was restored in 403 BC. And so with the restoration of democracy, there was also a very far-sighted amnesty law, which said you cannot accuse people of having been part of the oligarchic overthrow of democracy, because that will then, you know, it'll disrupt society. It'll pull us apart. Again, one thinks about Brexit. I'm sorry, I can't help it being in the UK.
Of course.
But yeah, so they said, don't try and you're not allowed to. It was illegal to say, to bring a case against someone for having been part of the other side. And so although people felt that Socrates was part of that oligarchic attempt to overthrow democracy, they couldn't bring a case against him for those reasons. So they brought case against him for other reasons, for sacrilege, not believing in Athens' gods, introducing new types of gods, and corrupting young men. And that clearly says something about the fact that he was a teacher of young men who tried to overthrow democracy, but it wasn't a political charge on the face of it.
This is Letters in Politics, and we are in conversation about the life of Socrates. Our guest is Armand Dangour, Associate Professor of Classics at Oxford, author of a number of books, including Socrates in Love, The Making of a Philosopher. I want to stay with his execution, even though your book is mostly about before the execution and as a younger man. And we'll get back to that period. But I think you bring up an important point, but I really want to underline in this conversation, because I think when we think of the execution of Socrates, it was because he insulted the gods and corrupted the youths. But this is actually, and you've said this, but again, I just want to underline this, what's really at play is a society that loses a war to Sparta, the Peloponnesian War, has tyranny, I think they're called the 30 tyrants or the 30 kings, right. Come in and take over. And then that's overthrown by a new democratic movement, I suppose. And it's that new set that came after that would see to the execution of Socrates.
Absolutely right. It's a very good summary.
So our understanding, I think our popular understanding, I don't know about how it is in England, but our popular understanding of Socrates' death is actually not quite what maybe the real reason was.
No, I think it's very, very poorly understood, actually. Most people say things like Socrates died for his principles, or Socrates died because, you know, he was a deeply moral person and Athens didn't understand him, all kinds of things that really have nothing to do with the actual facts of his execution. So he was put on trial for, I think it's absolutely clear, for political reasons which were not allowed to be stated openly. And therefore, he was charged for sacrilege, which, you know, all we can see from the evidence that we have is that is an absurdity. And he was charged with the corruption of young men, whatever that meant. I mean, the word corruption could imply sexual corruption. But, you know, the fact is the corruption that he was perceived as being involved with was political. In other words, anti-democratic agitation. So that was what his execution was about. And I think all that becomes pretty clear. Some years ago, some decades ago, I.F. Stone wrote a book called The Trial of Socrates, in which he laid it all out, I think, very clearly, that this was a trial for political reasons, and Socrates was executed. He was found guilty of these charges and executed. He didn't have to be executed. He chose to take the hemlock. He could have.
He didn't have to be executed. It's actually, if an execution could be funny, the funny thing about Socrates in this is that he probably could have argued for a less extreme sentence, but instead he argued that he should. What, be get like a state pension and should be honored?
Yes. Well, he said, you know, I've made Athens and Athenians think about their lives, think about what it is to be a good person. I've been a gadfly, he said, stinging the inert body of the state, and so that people wake up to their moral duty and responsibility. And therefore, I should be rewarded for it. And this was obviously a little bit provocative. And it was heard as provocative by the jury, a 500-strong jury. Yes, he could have been much more emollient if he'd actually wanted to get off. And therefore, some scholars have said he clearly didn't wish to save his skin. He wanted to die a heroic death. And that, I think, is an important point, because actually, when one looks back to his earlier life, a lot of it is devoted to becoming a hero. Becoming a hero in his early life meant being a military hero. And it's also clear that he was a highly effective soldier and indeed showed great heroism on the battlefield. He rescued his young friend Alcibiades from the thick of battle at one stage. So we know what a young Athenian man might have wanted to be in Socrates' youth, and that's clearly what he wanted to be. But he changed his mind at some stage, but he still wanted to be a hero. I think that's why he becomes a philosophical hero.
You have to infer many things when you're trying to do a biography of somebody who existed more than 2,500 years ago, or around 2,500 years ago, which there's not a lot of written record concerning his early life, much more about his later life. But do you think one could infer that Socrates, again, spends much of his first half of his adult life as a soldier, saw the what war meant, and then would it be fair to say later on, as you indicated, he was suspect of the democracy? Interesting to think how the people constantly were voting for war while the aristocrats were not, almost inverse of what we have, at least what we think we have here in the United States. Nonetheless, though, do you think that that was he sort of anti-war later on in his life?
No, and I think that that is one of the things that people romantically would like to assume. Surely, you know, a great moral thinker like Socrates would have been a pacifist. But the fact is, he was fighting up until his late 40s. And there's certainly no suggestion that he tried to duck out of that particular duty. So I think it's clear he felt he had a patriotic duty to Athens to fight on its behalf. Now, interestingly, we don't have any evidence that he ever killed anyone. And much of the evidence that we do have is that he fought in rather unsuccessful campaigns. And he was famous more for his ability to retreat in a way that was effective than to fight in a way that was effective. So who knows, you could create a romantic story whereby Socrates never did kill a man in battle, even though he fought in a dozen or more. But he actually rescued his young friend from the thick of battle, and he learned how to retreat with extraordinary grace and effectiveness. You could, if you wish. But I think that what is pretty clear is that he thought that being a patriotic Athenian soldier was part of the good life. It was part of what it meant to be a good person.
Now, much what we know about Socrates comes from Plato, who was his pupil, who saw, basically, Socrates, the trial and his execution, tried to convince him, tried to break him out, even, of his cell. Could it be argued that because Plato saw what happened to Socrates through the democratic processes, because you would vote, the juries would vote, there'd be like 500 jurists or something, and everyone would vote, and they voted for the execution of Socrates. Is it possible because Plato saw this that then he portrays a Socrates and even Plato's own work of being suspect and maybe concerned about democracy?
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, Plato himself clearly didn't care for the democracy. He was an aristocratic young man. Some of his relatives were involved in the oligarchic upheavals of the previous decade. So, yes, I think Plato may well have projected some of his own anti-democratic sentiments onto Socrates. But actually, what he wants to show Socrates as in the defense speech, which he puts in Socrates' mouth, the so-called apology, is that Socrates is indeed a keen democrat. So Socrates says in that speech, look, one of my main followers was a man called Chaerephon, and Chaerephon actually fought with the returning democrats and was killed. So Socrates wants to associate himself with those kinds of people, the people who fought on behalf of democracy. And I think that is something that Plato is at pains to show us. The Socrates himself was not actually anti-democratic. He may have been suspicious of Pericles. So he says somewhere that, if a leader has people who are reduced under his leadership, that's not going to be a good leader. Just as a shepherd whose flock is reduced under his shepherdship is not going to be a good shepherd. And that implication is that is given then that Pericles and others were not the best of leaders. But that's about it, really. Other than a somewhat critical view of the democracy under which he lived, Socrates presents himself as a democrat, someone who believes in the democratic system, and indeed is prepared to die because he is democratically voted death.
Armand Dangour is our guest. He is the author of the book, Socrates in Love, The Making of a Philosopher. We are talking about the life of Socrates, the biography. Armand Dangour, let's get into then the making of the philosopher. And I want to ask you about Socrates, and there are several people we're about to get into here in their relationship to Socrates. But first, let me ask you, who was Anaxagoras?
Okay, Anaxagoras was the most prominent philosopher of the early 5th century BC when Socrates was a young man in Athens. So Anaxagoras came from Ionia, which is modern Turkey, so the Greek states in what was then known as Ionia, Asia Minor for the Romans. And he came to Athens as one of the so-called sophists, these people who taught ideas. And his ideas are very wide-ranging. We have a lot of evidence for them, a lot of sources for different ideas that Anaxagoras came up with, ideas about evolution, for example, ideas about how the atomic system of the world works, sort of physical ideas of that kind. And he became the go-to philosopher for the leading citizen of Athens, Pericles. So they were great friends, Pericles and Anaxagoras. And Socrates is made to say in one of Plato's dialogues that when he'd heard that Anaxagoras had written a book about mind, he got very excited because he wanted to feel that the kind of philosophical school from which Anaxagoras came, dealing with a lot of physical ideas, what is the world made of, is it atoms, is it other kinds of elements and so on, he wanted to feel that actually there were bigger questions, such as, what's it all for? So he said, I heard that Anaxagoras had written about mind, and I thought, ah, he's going to tell us what the purpose of existence and creation is. And he bought the book, he says, for a drachma, which is a lot of money for a young man to spend on a book. It would be equivalent to a whole day's wage for a working man, you know, a few hundred dollars. So he bought this book, and he said he read it, and he was very disappointed, because for Anaxagoras, mind was simply a mechanical notion of what put things into motion in the world, rather than any guiding, purposeful being. And so he decided to give up on that kind of philosophy. But amongst the other things that Anaxagoras was noted for was his prediction of the fact that a meteorite was going to be a blazing hot stone. So he said that that's what meteorites were. And sure enough, when one fell in Greece during that period and turned out to be exactly that, everybody said, really, this is a guy who knows something about nature.
And I think what's important about Anaxagoras is this is where you start to see, and I think others too, I think of Thales, of Miletus, of replacing things that happen in the world, taking away the supernatural reasons for them happening. Again, the polytheistic society, gods are causing everything to happen, and instead making them natural causes.
Absolutely, yes. So he was famously a rationalist in that respect, in terms of physical phenomena, to suggest, for example, that the sun is just a blazing hot rock, which Anaxagoras said is as big as the Peloponnese, so he got the size slightly wrong, because it's a lot bigger than the Peloponnese. But other than that, the very fact that he could say such a thing when he was still living in a society where the sun was considered to be a divine object. Helios was the name of the sun god, and people prayed to Helios. So to say, well, look, it's a blazing stone of fire, which is what he did, was very, well, very modern, you might say. And there were other many ideas that Anaxagoras came up with, which were clearly rationalistic rather than superstitious.
And Socrates would get to know Anaxagoras as a young man through a relationship that Socrates had with an older man. See if I say this name correctly, Archelaus?
Very good, yes, Archelaus. So Archelaus was associated with Anaxagoras both in terms of his ideas and because ancient sources say he was his pupil. So the older philosopher then taught Archelaus, and Archelaus in turn taught Socrates. But we have one of the earliest pieces of evidence for the relationship of Archelaus and Socrates, which is very explosive, really. And it's repeated by one or two ancient sources. And people have tended to dismiss it. What it says is that Archelaus and Socrates were lovers. So the older man with a teenage Socrates, and they were lovers. Now, this is not something that was unusual in ancient Athens, at least not amongst the upper classes. They would have young men being introduced to older men who had some kind of power or influence or ability in order to be taught by those men. And sometimes, and it wasn't a necessary corollary, there was a sexual relationship between them, something that, of course, we frown upon, and actually some parts of ancient society also frowned upon. But it was considered, for at least a period in ancient Greece, perfectly natural that a young man could benefit from having a relationship, which might or might not involve physical relationship, with an older man. And we are actually told that is what Socrates had with Archelaus. And I think that's the kind of evidence we shouldn't just dismiss because it goes against our own sensibilities of what a great philosopher should be. That was simply the fact, and that is what we're told.
Why do you think this was suppressed? Do you think it was just society's view towards homosexuality here, say, in the 20th century?
Well, as I say, the social attitude amongst the upper classes was not not prohibitive of homosexual relations, and clearly there was a lot of that kind of thing going on in ancient Athens, perfectly acceptable amongst certain classes. But there were always those who felt that it was unacceptable, especially what we would now call pederasty, the love of a youngish man, a teenager, by an older man. And so that's certainly one reason why this was not widely repeated. Though I must say, no ancient source says it's an absolute slander. So where it is given to us, it is given to us as a matter of fact rather than as a malicious piece of gossip trying to make Socrates out to be something that he wasn't or whatever. So it is one of those things which I think that, yes, 18th, 19th, 20th century scholars wouldn't really be keen on. They didn't want to promote it. Therefore, it has, in a sense, been suppressed, or at least it's been ignored.
We couldn't have the great philosopher of Western civilization participating in something like that.
No, and, you know, the strange thing is that even in the dialogues of Plato, which are highly admiring of Socrates, there are several cases where Socrates is shown to have an enormous desire for a young man. And nobody disputes those particular instances. So Socrates was clearly bisexual in his inclinations, but there is one big and important dialogue called the Symposium by Plato, which is all about what does love mean, in which famously Socrates is someone who is considered to be older and uglier, and a younger, very attractive man, Alcibiades, tries to seduce him and tells the story in that dialogue about how he tried to seduce Socrates when they were together on active service in war, and that Socrates refused to be seduced by him. And so everybody takes from that, oh, Socrates had no homosexual inclinations. But the whole point of the dialogue is that this was something unusual, that Socrates decides that his love for Alcibiades is what we call platonic, precisely because it comes from that dialogue by Plato.
That is where we get that term, platonic love.
He's keen on a platonic relationship with Alcibiades because he loves his soul and he wants to improve his soul. And that's what Alcibiades says. And so he would not have sex with me. Clearly something that would have been thought really strange by people in that milieu in ancient Athens, that Socrates had this beautiful young man trying to seduce him and failed to be seduced by him.
What do you think that means then? Is that Plato, you think, or you think that actually is what happened?
I think it's likely to have been what happened, even though there are ancient sources which said, you know, if he had an affair with Alcibiades, that would have been perfectly normal. If he didn't, he was a fool. But I think actually that Plato, in reporting that, is trying to do a couple of things. One is he's probably trying to tell us what the actual status of the relationship between Socrates and Alcibiades was, which was one of deep and abiding love by Socrates for this young man and a desire to see him grow and improve. That is the way Alcibiades puts it in the Symposium. And I think the other thing is that this is a dialogue about the meaning of love. And it's very important for Plato that love is beyond what is physical love. That is what the whole doctrine portrayed in that dialogue is, that it starts with physical love, but it goes on to be something much greater and more transcendent than that. So it's important for him to show an instance, and one that I happen to think is likely to be the case, in which you have someone abstaining from physical love because he's more interested in higher things in a relationship with another person.
Socrates was married, perhaps more than once, and had children.
He was married. We're told by Plato of only one wife or partner, and that is the Xantippe. It's a name that's well known amongst people who study Socrates, and she was known to be a very demanding and difficult woman. In later authors, she's called a shrew, someone who gave Socrates a hard time. And so people have gone away with this image of Socrates and Xantippe is all we need to think about. But the fact is that Antiphe had a baby with Socrates when Socrates was on his deathbed at the age of 70. She brought the baby to the jail. Plato tells us that. So she can't have been that old. Let's say she was 30 when she had the baby with Socrates, and therefore they maybe met 10 years earlier. Socrates would already have been 60. So this wasn't, you know, he was famously a very lusty man, as we've seen with both sexes. This wasn't his first and only relationship. Socrates was not a virgin before he met and married Xantippe, aged 60. And so Aristotle tells us he did have another wife. He had an earlier wife, and she was an aristocrat. And so we can now see why Plato decided to suppress that particular fact in the early dialogues, where he's trying to present Socrates to be a good democrat. The fact that Socrates' earlier wife, Myrto, was a very elite birth would not have gone down well if Plato had wanted to present, you know, Socrates' democratic credentials. But that's what Aristotle, who was Plato's pupil, tells us. He married Myrto, and his first two sons were with Myrto. And Myrto would have been Socrates' contemporary. They came from the same village, and Myrto's father was Socrates' father's best friend, very aristocratic man. Lysimachus was his name. And Socrates, therefore, surely was introduced to Myrto when he was a younger man, perhaps in his 20s, and he had his first two sons with Myrto at that period. So I think Plato there does tell a porky, does tell a lie, in order to try and set Socrates up as something that he wasn't, which is a man of the people, you know, only married much later in life to Xantippe, with whom he had his children. The fact that Aristotle actually goes so far as to contradict Plato on this really quite trivial biographical matter is very important in my view. We should accept Aristotle's testimony.
In our remaining minutes together, I think we should round out Socrates' path towards becoming the philosopher that we would know, which would be an entire show of itself. But we were earlier talking about Anaxagoras and the influence of, I guess we'd say, very early natural sciences moving away from spirits or gods causing things to natural causes. But Socrates would not stay there, as you indicated. He would move on. What was that process? What did he move on to? And how do we get to this questioning and examined life that we now know Socrates as being?
Well, as you rightly say, the earlier philosophers were scientists, natural scientists. So the so-called pre-Socratics, the philosophical schools that existed prior to Socrates, were interested in the makeup of the physical world and the mechanical nature of the universe and so on. And Socrates' philosophy goes against all that and says, what is the good life? What is life about? In other words, he brings it to the human level. His philosophy is not metaphysical in that sense, or physical. It is ethical. The unexamined life, that is the life of the individual human being, is not worth living unless, you know, we have to examine the way we live. We have to ask questions like, what is goodness? What is justice? What is the truth? What is knowledge? What is love? These are very humanist preoccupations. Now, why do you change from one philosophical direction, which he would have been brought up in, as we've seen with Anaxagoras, with Archelaus, that whole philosophy which existed until the early 5th century and beyond, why would he have changed from that to a philosophy which is about how we should be, how we should act, what our conduct should be, what is the truth, what is knowledge? And it seemed to me that that change, which came about in his early life, must have been partly spurred by his own personal experiences. And so I was looking into what those experiences might have been. Well, what we find is that he met a woman whom we know of as Aspasia of Miletus, a woman who was eventually married or partnered with Pericles, the leading citizen of Athens, when they were both around 20. And by the age of 25, Aspasia was married to Pericles. And what happened in the 5 years before that? Well, one ancient source tells us before she was with Pericles, Aspasia was with Socrates. And Plato, in all his 30-odd dialogues, which are all about Socrates, has two in which Socrates is given instruction and accepts it, and both of those, the instruction is by a woman. In one of them, it is Aspasia who gives Socrates instruction on how to give a speech. So that is in the Menexenus of Plato. Aspasia herself is his instructor, and he respects and admires her instruction. And in the other dialogue, that is the Symposium, which is about love, Diotima is the name of the person. But this Diotima is introduced in such a way, and her very name, which means honored by Zeus, is an indication that she too was Aspasia. And the clues, which have never before been deciphered, the date of Diotima's existence and activity and her name and the meaning of it, are in my book as, I think, compelling proof that Plato's Diotima is Aspasia. And if that's the case, the things that Diotima teaches Socrates in the Symposium are absolutely fundamental to his philosophical direction thereafter. Because she teaches him about love. She teaches him that you have to define your terms. What is love, you have to ask before you can talk about acting in a certain way that is loving or not. And she teaches him that love is moving from the particular to the general. And those things are fundamental to Socrates' philosophy.
Well, this is important. How much do we know about Aspasia? As you mentioned, also coupled up or even married Pericles, who was the most powerful leader during this period of time. Do we know much about her beyond this?
Well, we have got quite a lot of independent evidence. And quite a lot of it comes from the comic playwrights. And the comic playwrights saw her as a hugely influential and very clever woman who had a malign influence, they thought, on her husband or partner, Pericles, who forced him to go to war, who made him belligerent, who somehow was equal to him, because whereas he was called Zeus, chief of the gods, because of his power and his oratory, she was called Hera, the queen of the gods, in comic plays. But they also called her a prostitute and a whore and a brothel keeper. And people have gone away with the idea that that's what she must have been. But there is no evidence at all that she can have been that, and all the evidence points against it. She was a clever, highly educated, highly influential woman. And, if I'm right, she was the teacher of Socrates as well as Pericles.
That's a big deal, to be the teacher of both of those people.
It is a huge deal.
And to be a woman, I mean.
Well, it is, you know, she was seen as an unusual, extraordinary woman by the ancient sources. Why don't we accept that? Because people have been more inclined to say, oh, well, she must have been a prostitute, because that's what the comic playwrights say. Well, if we believed everything the comic playwrights say, I mean, they were the purveyors of fake news in their time. So we shouldn't believe them. I think we should believe Plato and Xenophon, who say she was a respected teacher of Socrates. It's amazing that that has not been taken seriously. And the comic playwrights, whose job it is to make fun of people, were taken seriously.
And lastly, do you think, as we saw with the homosexual aspects of Socrates written out from classicists in the 19th and 20th century, that may have been a similar process with Aspasia?
Yes, I think that was exactly the case, that the 19th and 20th century scholars, they weren't happy with the notion that Aspasia was a prostitute or a brothel keeper. I mean, you know, she was married to Pericles for maybe 16 years. How could she have kept a brothel on the side when she was married to the leader of Athens? But so they weren't quite happy with that, though some still repeated those comic slanders. But others thought, no, she was probably a high-class prostitute, and they used the word courtesan. And most classicists are brought up with this view. And the word courtesan in Greek, hetaira, is something that everybody says, well, Aspasia was a hetaira. And actually, it was remarkable when I first started looking at the ancient sources to find out how many times she's called a hetaira. I was astonished to discover not a single ancient source calls her that. You either go with the comic playwrights and say she was a prostitute, or you say, with Plato and Xenophon, she was a teacher. Well, it is the most explosive discovery. And actually, you know, I lay out the evidence very clearly and for the identification of Diotima. Aspasia. And at the end of the book, I give the independent evidence and I say, if it's true, it is huge, because it means that there's a woman at the root of Western philosophy.
Armand Dengor has been our guest. Armand Dengor is associate professor of classics at Oxford. He has joined us for a conversation about the biography of Socrates. His book is called Socrates in Love, The Making of a Philosopher. Armand Dengor, that was very interesting, and I thank you greatly.
Thank you very much, Mitch. Very nice speaking to you.